Hey everyone, it's Josh, and while I'm hard at work on Season 3, I thought I'd take a moment to rebroadcast one of my favorite episodes from last season. I also wanted to remind you that not only is Season 3 in the works, but so are three other podcasts all debuting in early spring. That said, now's a really good time to stop by www.our-americana.com to see how you can help support the show. The show is run entirely on listener support. It is public radio. So drop by. You can either sponsor the podcast on a per-episode basis through patreon.com/ouramericana or give a one-time donation at paypal.com/ouramericana. The show could really use some additional support. And thanks again for listening, loving, sharing, and supporting the podcast. Enjoy the episode.
I think for every individual who was there, there were that many lessons being taught. There were messages of love. I think that was the strongest lesson I got from it, you know, like thinking and feeling it at a totally different level. I could sense the amount of love that the interaction between us all. Love seemed to be the overriding emotion. And everything stemmed from that. We were all dysfunctional and separated by different issues. And, you know, there's no strength in that family. So I think of Luna, I think of lessons that she taught me. She strengthened our personal relationships to where we are much more family-oriented. It's unconditional. I guess that's what it is, you know, like people pulled together a lot more. There was a lot more conversation. And people were just sharing meals a lot more. And when people got to talk and had some insight into each other's lives. And those were quite the times to be living in, for sure.
Our Americana is a weekly podcast where we explore small towns across the country and get to know the people who call them home. Join us as we head to some of our most unique and charming communities and talk to the locals about their lives, their histories, their relationships, and the stories that forever change them. Together, we'll discover how a community comes together and how it adapts and evolves when faced with the unexpected, the controversial, the bizarre, and the life-changing moments. I'm Josh Hallmark, and this is Our Americana.
Gold River is definitely off the beaten track. It's at the end of the road, west coast of Vancouver Island.
We have a population of somewhere between 1,350 and 1,400 people, so we're really small. No streetlight, no stoplights, anything like that.
One of the first things that strikes you, of course, when you drive in is just the natural beauty. You're surrounded by trees everywhere. It's a wonderfully wild place. It's, you know, one of the only places in the world where you can see a bear at the same time that you see a killer whale.
It's beautiful here. It's nestled in the mountains. We've got rivers, lakes, the ocean, wildlife, no cell service.
Used to have a mill, a pulp mill there, and it had closed down. And the thing I think that was quite interesting about it was the efforts that people were going to stay there, which gave an indication of how much most of the people who lived there loved the place.
And we have the best drinking water in the country. There's nothing in it. There's no fluoride, there's no chlorine, there's nothing. It's artesian well.
You got the sense that there was a longevity to the community. It's a resource-based town. There's people who have been there for a very long time, and it didn't feel like a transient community. It felt like a good, solid, working community with people who had been there a long time. So the whole idea of this story of Luna was completely new to everybody there.
I think a lot about the events that change us. How one single event can transform an entire community forever. Today, we're talking about Gold River, British Columbia, a sleepy logging village in Nootka Sound on the west coast of Vancouver Island. It was there that the arrival and persistence of a little stranger would put this tiny town on the map and at the center of an international conversation about what to do when conservation and humanity collide. It was early July of 2001 when Luna, a baby orca, arrived in Nootka Sound. He was first sighted by the U-Chuck, a regional supply and cruise boat that he had begun following around, until eventually Luna followed the U-Chuck straight to dock in Muya Bay at Gold River.
It's quiet. It was better when the mill was up and running. The mill shut down in 1998. And we went from about 4,000 people down to about 1,500. So things really changed, but it's nice here. The demographics have changed. It went from a young person's town to kind of almost a semi-retirement community. So it's quiet, it's nice here.
This is Donna Schneider. She was a chef on the U-Chuck and one of the first people to encounter Luna in Nootka Sound.
We were used to seeing a lot of whales, different whales, minkies, humpbacks, all kinds of wildlife. And when we spotted this whale, we actually thought it was a pilot whale at first. It didn't look like an orca. And then finally, I saw it come out of the water, and it was like, oh, this is a baby orca. So we were pretty excited. Well, we actually thought it was a transient at first, because if you see one orca, it's normally not a resident orca, which has a family. So we paid a lot of attention to it, but we just didn't figure it out. And finally we called Graham Ellis and a couple of others, John Ford and stuff, and said, you know what, we have this whale here. We're not sure what's going on. And they came up, took a look and went, oh my gosh, that's a whale that we presumed was dead. They kind of took on a wait and see what happens approach to this whale because he appeared to be healthy. So we were kind of excited. It was a big secret. The world really didn't know about him just yet. And so we got to observe him for a long time before the media got a hold of it.
At what point did you realize he was there because he was trying to fill the void that he lost when he lost his pod?
We had a conversation with one of the whale experts, and that's kind of some of the stuff he said was likely to happen. It was interesting to watch him evolve because we saw him in Muya Bay, and he stayed there for a long time. He didn't go out of this sort of triangle area. But as he got a little more comfortable with boat traffic and stuff like that, he started to follow us. He started to follow the boat. So he was getting out of his comfort zone. And finally, after quite a few months, he made his way all the way to Gold River. He just evolved. He just kind of started to bring over logs and kelp and things like that, things to play with. I don't know why. I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect that sort of friendship with him. Well, I got to see him almost daily when I went to work, which at that time of the year was 5 days. And at the beginning, we were allowed to stop. We weren't allowed. We stopped the boat and let the passengers have a look. And we would, you know, lower a pallet and we'd play with them and stuff like that. And then after a while, we were told we weren't allowed to stop. And so that kind of broke my heart because at that point, he wasn't really following us too much, so we would not stop. And you could see him sort of spy hopping and going like, where are you guys going? Why haven't you stopped? And it was painful because we really wanted to stop. And then once he got to the dock, it was more fun for me because he hung around the boat and I played with him with the hose. He loved to be sprayed. And we almost played a game of hide and seek where I'd lean over the rail and he'd duck under the boat. And then I'd look over the rail and he's kind of sneaking out to see where I am. I don't know, I just got super attached to him. He just was a lot of, he was like a puppy. He just wanted to be around everybody. I mean, down at the dock besides us was active booming grounds and he'd go over and play with the dozer boats and push the logs. And he just wanted to be around everybody. He loved the action. It was funny. I have a story for you. We had a funeral on our boat, or what do you call it? Not a funeral, but a celebration of life, I guess you want to say. And the lady wanted to put her husband's ashes over the side of the boat out by Friendly Cove. And Loon followed us out there, and we did our little thing on the boat, and I wasn't sure where Luna was. It's wide open water where we were, and he could have easily left, and I just thought, well, he may be gone. He may be out in that open ocean now, and we've let him out to freedom. We don't know. And by the time she put the ashes into the water, he did his stealth mode, and he came right up between the ashes, right through the ashes in the water. And everybody just started crying. And then he just laid there on top looking at us like, oh, why are you guys so sad? So it was just an unreal situation. But it was so cool at the same time.
Was there any point where it stopped being surreal and just became normal?
I don't think so. I don't think so. It was, it seems surreal now. Even still, it seems like a dream. One of the funny things about watching Luna evolve was he was getting chased and almost attacked by some of the sea lions because they're fighting for the same food. And he had some bad scratches along his back. And, you know, he would kind of swim away from them. And then as time went on, they're fishing together. It was really amazing to see. He wasn't running from them. They weren't chasing him. They were all in the same area. You could see them all out there fishing. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, it was really nice. Really nice to see, because we worried about that. There was a lot of sea lions in the area.
I was living in a little duplex up on the res there, and my next door neighbor was Jerry Jack, so I got to talk with Jerry a lot, and he often mentioned about having a conversation with Ambrose McQuinna regarding their stages in our lives, and Ambrose had mentioned he was getting along and that he was going to come back as a kuckoo.
This is Eugene Amos, a member of the Muwakchot Muchalot First Nations tribe. Shortly before Luna's arrival in Nootka Sound, the tribe's chief, Ambrose McQuinna, told his people that he would be dying soon and that he'd come back as a kokolin, a Muwakchot word for killer whale. 4 days after his death, Luna showed up. The tribe would come to know Luna as Suksit, Ambrose's nickname.
Which was really funny to Jerry at the time. And I guess, you know, it wasn't too long after that when Luna did show up. I first saw it. It was just tiny, just a small little mini version of what he was to become. Yeah, he was pretty tiny, but he was always so hungry for attention and friendship. It was something.
How did Gold River and the First Nations react when he first showed up?
I think when he first showed up, people by and large kind of came to the same conclusion and were saying Ambrose did come back. That was kind of the general consensus in my eyes. But for me personally, it was a little bit different. After Ambrose had passed, the following day, my younger sister Louise, she got killed in a terrible head-on collision. My nephew Joshua, who was Louise's second son, it was his birthday. July 14th was also the wedding day of my baby sister, Irene. So we had the three big events occurring all on the same day. And when I first met Suksit, I saw almost like a personification, or, you know, like I saw my family and ancestors in that whale. I saw the characteristics, the behavior, etc., etc. I saw a lot of the similarities between ancestors and my family, and where other people, because of their different connections and that, they saw Ambrose. So for me, it was a little bit different compared to the rest of them. he came to me personally, and, you know, like right to my fingertips. There was a connection made. We kind of knew what each other, what was on each other's mind. It was kind of a almost unbelievable and surreal thing. But it happened. I was there. You know, this one time, I was paddling on the left side of the canoe, and he would come up right beside me, and then he'd blow underneath my armpit as I was paddling. And I said, "Sukhi, you cut that out." And I said, "Why don't you go see Gary? Go bother Gary." And he just went underneath the canoe, and I heard him click, 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 click. Sounded like he was doing me a good cussing out. He went to the other side, and he checked out the different guys there. And he finally, he turned his head to have a good look at someone, and look at with a single eye, and he saw Gary, and he stopped right beside him, and he started with a whale talk. He said, sounded like Gene didn't want to play with him, so he told me to come and see you. That's what it seemed like. You know, that feeling was so powerful. He did a lot of goofy things like that with different people. That night we paddled all the way out to Gloria McQuinna, the widow. She was sitting down on the dock, and she had her feet in the water. He was playing with her feet. He'd bring her a stick, and then he'd play with a big long piece of kelp, and he'd trail fronds over her feet, you know, and then it was like he was trying to tickle her feet. But it was really cute to watch that encounter. And I said, geez, I wonder if there is something to the Ambrose story of him coming back. Yeah, there was some pretty cool encounters for sure.
While Luna made friends and settled into Muya Bay, tensions began to build amongst the residents of Gold River, the First Nations tribe, and local biologists. While the First Nations and most Gold River residents considered Luna a treasure, some thought the whale was a nuisance. You see, Luna's friendly play was occasionally damaging boats and seaplanes. One such owner even threatened to shoot Luna. And the local biologists were more and more concerned that the longer Luna stayed and the more comfortable he became, the more likely something terrible would happen. The story of Luna and the tensions over what should be done with him began to spread from the isolated shores of Vancouver Island out across the world, and the media trickled in to Gold River to cover the story of the little whale who was causing a giant ruckus. In 2004, journalists Mike Parfit and Suzanne Chisholm came to Gold River for a short writing assignment for Smithsonian Magazine. They became so attached to Luna, however, that they stayed for 3 years and would eventually release The Whale, a documentary about Luna's life in Nootka Sound.
I was working a lot for Smithsonian Magazine, and a friend of ours wrote from the magazine and said, what's going on in your part of the world that you might want to write about? And we had read news articles about this attempt that was going to be made to reunite a little whale with its pod. And so we looked it up some more and wrote Smithsonian. And they said, oh, that sounds like an interesting story. And so without ever having gone to Gold River, we got the assignment. I've lived in rural communities most of my life, and Suzanne is from a small town. So we are very comfortable with small communities. There's certain mythology about what small towns are like nowadays. This was a community like many that we've been in, which is a small rural community which has a large variety of people and a very strong sense of its own character. And so we found it wonderful being there. We really found the people to be unexpectedly welcoming. Most members of the press are on short deadlines and short leashes. And so there's more of an opportunity for them to have conflict with the people they're trying to cover, just because they're trying to get things done in a hurry, which we know about that. We sympathize with that. I'm not trying to be critical of them. It's just the nature of it. We have decided over the years to take our time with people. And so we always make the effort to spend much more time. And so that's why we were able to get to know the community. By then, the community was already a little bit gun shy about journalists. And so even though they were naturally welcoming, they were still a little skeptical of who we were. But we just kind of took our time to start to get to know people.
And tell me about your first encounter with Luna.
You better do that one, Mike.
Yeah, that was not what we expected, planned, hoped for, any of the above. It was really unexpected. We had a little Zodiac that we were running around. It was just a little Zodiac that we were running around in. And we had all these ideas about how to avoid him, because we were strongly convinced that one shouldn't interact with him, because that was the what you were supposed to do. That was sort of the rules at the time. So we were having to go somewhere up by this place called Muya Bay, where he essentially headquartered himself. And we were told by somebody who was there that as long as we could go faster than about 8 knots, we'd have no problem staying away from him if he was even there. We had no idea whether he was there at the time or not, but this was a couple of weeks after we'd started work. And so we started crossing this bay area in our little Zodiac. Now, this is a small boat. You know, it was about 13 feet long and 15 horsepower motor. It's not a big boat. So we're zooming across the bay, and suddenly we saw a little tiny white spout off in the far distance. It was really a long way away, and we thought, oh, wow, he's there. And our plan was to go and get up on the rocks and to try to see if we could see him. So at that point, we saw that, and we realized, well, he's way too far away to catch up with us, and so we'll just zip over to the rocks and get up, and we'll actually get to see him. So we were quite excited about that. And then so we did speed up a little bit and try to stay away from that area where we'd seen him off in the distance. So we're zooming along and still not concerned. And all of a sudden, he comes up about probably 50 meters away, something like that, where you could actually see him come out of the water. It wasn't just a little white spout anymore. It was a little thing, but he was behind us. He was sort of probably just off to the right, slightly behind us. And so the idea that we were going well over 7.5 knots, we were going about 16 or 17 knots, we were zipping right along. That was fine. It was great. He was out there. We could see him. And we're heading for these rocks, and we're getting pretty close, so we're going to hop up on the thing. We still weren't concerned. The next thing that happened is he exploded right beside the boat. Actually touching it as he came up out of the water. His side touched our boat and he exploded. I mean, there's no other word for it. He totally exploded. The splash that he made and the blow that he gave, you know, to come up for air were just an explosion. And that was shocking, surprising, extremely intense. So we had no idea that would happen. We never thought, even when we saw him, that would happen. So he exploded right there. I mean, he was about, I would say, about 1.5 feet from where Suzanne was sitting and about 3 feet from where I was sitting driving the boat. And he just blew up right there. Boom. And then we were on those rocks that we were going to. And he peeled away and was out there. And we kind of staggered up, pulled the boat up on the rocks and staggered up onto the beach, trying to make sense of what we had just experienced. So I think that if we had looked at it in any symbolic way, the explosive arrival of this whale into our lives was simply symbolic of what was to come.
The story is so complex and so layered. And one of the things I always have a hard time with is, how do you separate the once-in-a-lifetime fantasy of him being there and relating with you to the reality of the situation that he's in?
Yeah, I think that the bottom line is it was heartwarming and heartbreaking at the same time, because you knew for him you know, if there's one thing that we know about orcas, and there are many things, but I think one of the key points about orcas is that they are incredibly social animals. They're very, very linked to their families, particularly their moms. They spend their entire lives together in very close proximity. So if you think about it from Luna's point of view, which we often, almost always did, to be honest, it's a crummy life for him away from his family. We don't know the reasons why he was separated. So that part of his story to us was always heartbreaking. At the same time, the fact that he, you know, literally reached out to humans to connect, that made us think that, you know, these are amazing animals. And it's not to say that we think that we were ever a good substitute for his pod, but the fact that he obviously found some stimulation in interacting with people in the same way that he enjoyed playing with sea lions. You know, we all do the best we can in whatever circumstance we're in. And I think we could say the same of Luna. So there were always feelings of huge conflict, you know, ranging from wow to, oh my gosh, this is really, really a bad situation for him.
Before and throughout the various debates over and attempts at reuniting Luna with his pod, the Department of Fisheries took a hard stance that the more people interacted with him, the more likely he was to stay. So they instituted tough love laws. People were not to engage with, make eye contact with, or even look at Luna. As you can imagine, between a love and fascination with Luna and Luna's own persistence to build a community for himself, these tough love laws were increasingly impossible to enforce. They also sparked controversy over what exactly was the right thing to do for Luna and who ultimately should be making that decision.
I think what has struck me is I still don't have a strong sense of what is right. It's this nature versus nurture in a very literal sense. We base our identities on knowing what's best for us. And then there is this hubris of humans deciding that we knew what was best for Luna as opposed to Luna knowing what was best for Luna. How did you feel when they decided that the tough love was the right way to go?
Well, I definitely had mixed feelings about that, and because we didn't know, because this was something so new, it made me pretty angry that people were starting to put rules out there or thought they knew what was best for the whale. And my personal opinion was that when Luna became sexually mature, that he would probably take off. And so in the meantime, though, just watching how brave he started to get and how much traffic actually ended up in the area because of Luna, he did need to be kept safe somehow. But I know we confused the heck out of the poor little guy, you know? At one point, everybody was there and allowed to touch him, and the next time, nobody was allowed to. They had to take off. There was lots of boat traffic. Come fall and winter, there's no boat traffic. There's nobody. I mean, the poor guy just must have thought, what the heck is going on? And so when the stewardess first started and there was all this hullabaloo down at the dock, we had people with megaphones and clipboards and, I don't know, flashlights and everything else, and they're telling people to stay away. I don't know, I got really angry. It was like, how do we know? How do we know we're doing the right thing?
And now that some time has passed, what do you think was the right thing?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one, because I think if we could have, near the end, if we could have lured him out to the open ocean and tried to get him back to his pod, who knows? I think it could have worked. There's whale experts going, no, it wouldn't work, it wouldn't work. But how do we know? This whale was so different from any other whale that they've studied. You know, right from his birth, he was a one-off. So it's one of those things, we'll just never know if we did the right thing or not.
Did you ever break the rules?
Absolutely.
How could you not?
Yeah, how could you not? That's right. I mean, I would go down to the lower dock, so I'm right at water's level, and I'd slap the water, and he'd come over, and we'd have a little gab session, and, you know, he'd bring me little fish or a piece of wood or something to play with, and I couldn't stop doing it, and I would have gone to jail if I had to.
The whole rules, the thing about the rules about not making contact with him was fascinating because we completely bought into all of that. You got to stay away from him. It's for his own survival, all of that sort of stuff. And that was, those were rules that were essentially superimposed on the situation by the scientists, primarily the scientists from outside. We didn't really think about them as well as maybe we should have at the time, but we agreed with them. So for us, we immediately were put in the same position as the people who lived in the community, which was we suddenly saw a living being, a living social being that was desperate for contact. And we believed it should not be given to him, and therefore we had to stay away from him. Personally, we did, and we thought everybody else should. And so that's an immediate personal conflict, a conflict of within your own heart. And that immediately sort of took over in terms of our sense of our connection to this story, was that specific conflict. He desperately needs social life, but we can't give it to him. And that's really part of the heart of the story. And it is interesting that, you know, here was this little town, and a little town off in the boonies, the social connections that people have in those towns, in towns like that, like Gold River, are very important. They were the reason that people tried to stay there when the mill closed and didn't just get up and leave. It was because of the connections they had. So these people really understood when a stranger came into town and needed connection. And so that's why so many of them went out there and actually broke the rules and looked him in the eye or touched him. Many of them were doing it because they felt he needed it. Now, there were some people who were out there like, as you know, as if it was a marine park. But that was not the case with most of the people who actually lived there. The people who sort of treated Luna like a toy or like an exhibit were people who came in from the outside and just went out to kind of see him for the day. But the people who lived there and went up and down Nootka Sound all the time really cared about what he needed. And so a lot of them did new research so that they could learn about whales. A lot of them found out about Luna's family for the first time. A lot of them learned about whales' social lives for the first time. People studied who Luna was and what he needed in order to try to somehow help him solve the big problem of his life. He had lots of food, but the big problem of his life was he had no social life, and that was as important to him as life itself.
I still can't really reconcile whether it's doing the right thing or the hubris of people deciding what's best for a whale.
I think there are a number of ways to look at that, you know, and it's in the broader context of conservation, what is the human role here? I mean, the fact is we humans have changed a lot of things, not just for the orcas. You know, we've encroached on their habitat. We've made it harder for them to catch salmon, which they need to survive. And in Luna's case, we didn't cause him to be there, but, you know, there are some people who would say that we humans encouraged him to stay there by actually responding, by giving him that attention. I'm not saying I necessarily agree with that. So, you know, it's a really complicated thing. What should we as humans do? Do you help someone or something or some situation if you can? You know, that's the first question. And then the second question is what is the best way to help an individual or a species or a habitat? And those are things that, you know, luckily I think most of us are approaching really tough questions like that with an open mind and an open heart and really trying to think about what makes most sense. The really tricky part is that in the situation that we had with Luna, nobody really knows. We, you know, there's not a lot of precedent for these kinds of things. And what do we know? I mean, he can't speak to us the way that we can speak to each other, even though they, you know, he can communicate with his family. He's got a huge set of needs, but there were times when we would just sit there in our boat and, you know, be close to tears. We'd be like, what is it that we can do for you, Luna? You know, what is it that you want? And that's really hard. But I think we, you know, in the end, we have an obligation to do better for these individuals and for these animals and for the habitat and for the environment as a whole, because we have made terrible mistakes again and again and again. And I think we have an obligation to to try.
The thing about these connections with animals is he was trying to communicate with us somehow, and it was obviously frustrating to him not to be able to. He would do all kinds of things, splashing his fins to make noise on the water, all this sort of stuff, and squeaking, making all kinds of noises. And one of the things that we thought eventually as a sort of principle in these situations or any situations with animals is try to listen to what they're asking for. And try to get a sense of what they're really asking for. Because in most cases, what wild animals need from us is distance. They don't want us nearby. Most of the time, they really don't want us nearby. So when an animal comes up to us and needs something, we should try to pay attention to what it is that the animal is asking for. And that question was not difficult with Luna. He really wanted contact. You saw pictures of him wanting his tongue scratched. He would rub up against the boat. He would welcome contact when he wanted it, and he wanted eye contact. He wanted all of these social connections. And with the little town of Gold River, the people there sort of instinctively, well, this is just like all the rest of us that are stuck out here in this very distant spot without a whole big city around us to provide, multiple people to see. We all need this connection, so it's no different from any of the rest of us. And I think that's, to a large degree, what he was asking for. So in these odd situations where an animal actually needs something from you, that's when you respond.
I know there was a lot of inconsistency about how to handle him over his time there. Do you think during the, tough love periods, did you ever feel like you were abandoning him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just it felt like this was the cruelest. I mean, we felt like that all the way along while we were doing it, because for most of the time we were there, we did not have for well over a year, we didn't have any contact with him. There, we would watch him from a distance at the dock and all of those things, and that felt cruel. It immediately felt cruel, and it always felt cruel, but it felt like tough love. It felt like it was the thing to do. It was only later we began to see, after we did a little research and it indicated that the contacts with people were made, sort of 80% of them were started by Luna, not started by the humans, that he was going to make contact one way or the other, and that we probably should try to set something up so he could have that contact if he wasn't going to get connected to his pod, so he could have that contact without endangering himself. But the sense we had that we were being cruel to him by not giving him consistent contact was extreme. I mean, there were times literally where we felt like crying because of that sense of it felt almost like it was betrayal of our own, expectations of social connection. We recognized something there in an orca. We recognized the need for others in this orca that we understood from our own need for others. And that made it very hard.
You know, we've done an awful lot of school presentations and screenings over the years. And I think one of the reasons why this film and Luna's story resonates among everyone, different cultures, but kids in particular, is they see the inconsistency with which people treated Luna, and they experienced that inconsistency on the playground, in the schoolyard. And if there's one thing that we humans can't stand is when someone's our friend one day and changes their mind the next day. And everyone has experienced that, and we can recall the heartbreak of when we were kids and how that felt. And, it's not an exact analogy, but I think to Luna it must have been really, really confusing. Because, they're smart animals, and he was obviously aware that some days people would come over and interact with him, and other days, oh, why aren't they here, And so I think that strikes at the heart of many, many people and puts it into context.
What do you think was the best thing?
Oh, definitely we think that there should be, in all these cases, there are other cases elsewhere in the world, but we really think that the only way to save animals that are really isolated like this, is to eventually set up a safe way of interacting with the same people or with a certain group of people. Because, if we look at what we think of as friendship, Susanna was just talking about, is consistency. And his life with his pod would have been full of consistency. And that's what we think. If there had been a boat out there which had made regular contact with him, didn't try and force itself on him, but was there when he needed it and was a safe boat for him to be around.
But I think it's also very important to look at this across a spectrum of time, because it's not like we think as soon as a dolphin or a beluga right. whale or an orca shows up in a community, all of a sudden you should be out there scratching his tongue. So I just want to clarify, neither Mike nor I think that's the case. I think all these cases have to be looked at individually and say, what is in this animal's best interest? In the case of belugas or bottlenose dolphins, we often don't know where their families are. As exciting as some of the technological changes are, we still don't know all of the belugas or all of the dolphins. With orcas, you know, I have no doubt in my mind that it would have been great if Luna had had the opportunity to reunite with his family. So again, we just want to be careful and say, you know, it's not like we think right away you should go out and interact, and you have to look at what's happening at the particular context, you know, at the particular time when management becomes an option. And I think in our case, you know, we came on board quite late. It was abundantly clear to us that Luna was very accustomed to human interaction. And it's not to say that he couldn't go back to being a full-time wild whale. Nobody knows what that outcome would have been. But I think we have an obligation to manage things in the context in which they present themselves and based on the science. And that was one thing that frustrated us. You know, on the one hand, it's true that the more interactions in general people have with wild animals, the more frequently things end up badly for either the human or the animal or both. You know, but at the same time, we know how social these animals are, these orcas in particular. So, what is the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think I would. I'm glad Suzanne clarified that, because I think that our idea that you have to have a connection, you need to set up some kind of safe way for the animal to connect, is only after it's very clear that they're not going to be going away back to their family, and that they aren't going to find what they really do need. If they're really stuck, then I think that connection needs to be made. If they're not stuck, then probably withholding it for a period of time may make them go out and look for their family once again. So that's the thing. You don't want to give them something prematurely. But when they get stuck like Luna was, that's when we felt that it was cruel to withhold the social life that they really need for survival. But we were very tortured about that in our hearts throughout. We never felt sure about the solution, but we did feel that we wanted to keep him alive, and that would mean that he would have to be kept away from some of the more dangerous boat, and that in order to do that, you would have to have the connection. But, you know, early on, in his first, I think in just a little over a year, somebody offered to lead him back to his pod by using his tendency to connect with people. They wanted to lead him back to the pod, and that would have, in our view, would have been the solution, where if they had led him back to the pod, he probably would have connected up just fine. And somebody said no, just based on the sort of philosophical idea that whales and humans shouldn't connect. And that was probably the turning point, because that opportunity was very clear. You didn't have to have, you wouldn't have had to have all of this huge, they tried this huge thing to try to move him, to capture him and move him back to the pod. You wouldn't have had to do that. You would have just been able to lead him away and lead him back to where the pod was. And then it was a very short time that he'd been gone, about a year. They would have taken him back almost certainly. So that was tragic that was prevented. But it was sort of on the basis of almost an ideological idea. Well, no, you just can't. You can't interact with these animals. You know, you can't do it. You just can't do it. And it's been tried in many different places over the years with belugas and with dolphins. The idea that you can't interact with them, and you have to try to prevent people from interacting with them, has dominated the policies and has always failed. Because the animals are very, very, very persistent. And belugas and dolphins, they're all social animals, and they're very persistent in making these contacts. So a better solution needs to be found, and a piece of that solution is a safer way of actually interacting.
If you could go back to those days, would you do anything differently?
No, I don't think so. I think everything went the way it should have in my eyes, and I don't see it unfolding any differently. And I don't think I could have wrote it up any better than that either.
Next week on Our Americana. Tensions over what to do with Luna come to a head, just as the Department of Fisheries makes a deal to relocate Luna, a quiet deal that Gold River residents quickly become suspicious of.
I knew eventually something bad was going to happen, and I was really angry that they weren't doing what I thought would be in his best interest. And I was scared. When they tried to capture him and put him in that pen, I thought, that's it. He's going to an aquarium, and we're going to have a whole different fight on our hands here.
My hands were bloody from blisters that had opened up. They said, oh, the hands will heal, you know, but if Luna gets captured, that's not going to heal. So it became a kind of a labor of love kind of thing to paddle around with him.
They saw a large group of his family very close to Nootka Sound passing by.
And Luna forges a profound bond with a First Nations tribe member.
I think watching him interact with Jamie was among the most dramatic, poignant things that I recall.